The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight is on the UDC Foundation. Why give to UDC? Well, the University of the District of Columbia, celebrating its 160th anniversary, offers more than 70 academic programs and numerous certificate courses that assist in improving the lives of Washington residents. Private funding supports the university in fulfilling its mission of providing quality, affordable, and accessible education to students in the district and beyond. To find out how you can support, visit federalnewsradio.com. This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about income taxes, benefits, a little bit of long-term care, and of course the January annuity checks and February annuity checks. And it's John Elliott and I. John, federal benefits strategist, retired Fed, fellow seminar presenter, co-host of the show, along with Tammy. Well, we all three of us do it when we do it together, because you have to have a benefits person, and I'm a tax person. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
And today is February
7th.
7th, a week before Valentine's Day.
Yeah, don't forget that.
No, I'd be in big trouble. And we're live. It's 10:06 a.m. Eastern Time. We run to about 10:58 Eastern Time live. Give us a call if you like. We're at 202-465-3080. And after that, don't call us, but you can listen to us 24/7. We're archived at NITPINC.com. Left-hand side of the homepage, it says For Your Benefit Radio Show. Okay. First thing, John, you're a retired Fed, but you're also a fellow seminar presenter. But your check, not to be nosy, I don't need to know the dollar amounts, but did you notice your retirement check go down in February?
I did. It was more than $50, as I recall. I can't, I don't have it in front of me, the statement. But, of course, anytime your annuity check changes, OPM will send a statement explaining the change, and they did. And there was a remarks explaining the, roughly what happened and why, your tax withholding went up because, they didn't, it didn't need to be corrected, but there was no action on some portion of the law connected with the,
But you didn't find
extension of the regular tax cuts.
Okay, you didn't find that to be the case with your January annuity check, though, correct? Your January annuity check was the same as it was in the prior year.
Well, you get paid 1 month in arrears. So,
Your January 1st, let's call it. January 2nd.
No, that would have been for December.
I know that, but. Okay, now
no,
here's
I didn't
where
notice it.
People...
But the one I got February 1st in the mail, normally it goes directly to my bank, the money, but I did get a notice in the mail around February 1st explaining what happened.
Okay, let's take a look at how we all pay taxes as individuals very quickly. This won't take 15 seconds. We pay taxes on when we get the money. It's not when we earn the money. So the January check that people got for December, it was December's check, but it didn't come till January.
True enough.
And it's just like a W-2. If your W-2 covers a pay period that ended in December and you get it, you pay it in January. Okay. So in January, there was no change because it was the same as the prior 12 months in 2010 because we're cash basis taxpayers. Now, why didn't it change? Well, Congress debated tax law until mid-December. They changed the tax law or extended the tax law, however you want to look at it. Some of the things in the tax law changed. Now, clearly, with 2 weeks to go between that date and the January 1st annuity check, there's no way that they were going to correct the withholding charts. No way. So they did correct them, and they corrected them in January. So early February, the January annuity check that they got in February, reflected the new withholding tables. Now, remember the tax law changed, not drastically so, but one of the things that they cut out was something called the making work pay credit. The making work payment credit doesn't have one single thing to do with a person that's fully retired. None. Because they're not working. However, withholding charts are not designed for retirees. They're not designed for firemen. They're not designed for law enforcement. They're not designed for SESers or anybody else for that matter. There is a withholding chart, and the only difference is if you file single or joint or head of household. That's it. So it's based on your income. Now, what is your income? All this issue that we have are people that are retired that saw their annuity checks drop because the withholding went up. And they said, well, the work for pay credit really has nothing to do with me. It's true, but it has everything to do with the withholding tables. Because remember, the tables aren't written for retirees or for worker bees. So the making work pay credit was built in to actually provide retirees a greater annuity for the last 2 years. I didn't notice one letter January 2009 saying, gee, I got more on my check than I should have. But they did because they had the work for pay credit in there. But then they cut it out, so it went back. And that's the issue. So some of the folks that have called in to the office as well as written say, you know, how am I going to get this refund? Well, I don't think, and I can't speak for OPM, but I doubt OPM is going to send out all the people that are retired a $40 or $50 or $60 or $20 check. I just don't think that's going to happen. But what they can do is they can adjust their withholding at OPM to make sure that they don't have that excess withheld. Sure. And I bet you know how to access that better than I.
Well, you can go to their website, opm.gov, and click on retirement benefits. And then there's a retirement page that has a list of services you can do online. One of them is adjust your federal and state tax withholding. And you just need your password, PIN and your, I guess, password. I haven't done it in a while. I have done it. It's very easy to adjust your tax withholding online. I've also done it earlier in my retirement by phone, which is also just as easy. You know, it's an automated attendant. You just, if you have a touchtone phone, or you just punch in what you need to do. Also very easy. The toll-free number is at their website if you'd prefer to call in as opposed to do it online, except the last time I did it, which was some time ago, I did it online and found it to be a snap. So if this thing that they, this extra withholding is burdensome for you, you can adjust it very easily.
And I would think it would be burdensome for those that that's their single source of income. However, be aware for those of you that have other than annuity income, might have Social Security income that may or may not be taxed depending on the size of the annuity, but they might have a part-time job, the smallest of part-time jobs. Well, watch out with your withholding, because at the end of the year, all sources of income are added together to calculate one's income. So you might have a small source of second career income, if you will. You have your annuity income. You may or may not have Social Security income. But at the end of the year, all of those are added together. And the tax is calculated on the sum, not on the parts. So be careful with your withholding. Yes, you can adjust the withholding, and John gave you the way to do it, and it's a great suggestion. But don't go crazy with it if you have these other sources. Because if you do work and you did get the work for pay credit, whatever they call it, you're not going to get it in 2011.
Well, and particularly if you're working where no taxes are withheld and you also owe Social Security tax, which is my case. You know, I work I'm essentially, for tax purposes, self-employed. So no taxes are withheld for what I make during the year, including not only my employee Social Security contribution of 6.2%, but I also have to pay the employer share. So I'm paying 12.4%. Now I get part of that back, as you know,
tax
Bob,
deduction.
And tax deduction. The part of the half the employer share, is it?
Right.
Yeah. And then, of course, and then I have to pay Medicare tax as well, that 1.45, in my case, double 1.45. So, yeah, I always end up owing a substantial amount each year to the IRS.
And if you do, and it's more than a certain amount, you may have to pay a penalty, but the penalty is extremely small.
Right, that's what you've told me in the past. For the first time, I did estimated tax on the instructions of my accountant. So
you listen to your accountant. That's good.
I recommend if you're paying somebody, you should listen to them until as long as they're giving you good advice, and so far so good.
All righty. So that's the issue with withholding. There were some other changes to the tax law that will also impact one's ability to even file a tax return. There are certain provisions in the current law that were extended into 2011, but they would impact the filing of the 2010 return. Now, the filing of the 2010 return is, of course, done in 2011, and a lot of the people that are impacted by this would be people who itemize their deductions. People that don't, that claim what's called the standard deduction, they didn't put off filing their taxes, with one exception. If they happen to have if they are a teacher, they've gone off to a second career, or they're married to a teacher that has, they call it an above-the-line deduction, it's a $250 deduction. There was an issue with that that's not going to be on the return, so you need to wait till February for the IRS's computers to get ready, and no one should throw any rocks at the computers or Congress. It just took Congress a long time to come up with a compromise to get the thing done, and you can't turn on the dime and reprogram your computers. So that would be one thing. And then with regards to itemized deductions, one thing that was to go away that has come back was the ability to claim sales taxes in some states that don't have income taxes, or sales taxes in states that have a very low income tax, and you get the higher of the two number. So that provision was to expire, but Congress decided to let it alone for another at least a year. So that's why those folks can't file, and then that, of course, would impact anybody else, because they can't get the form out, and they can't get the processing done. So anybody that itemizes ought not to file till, I believe it's February 13th, so it's next week. So that's just a precautionary comment. Now, as far as planning goes, there isn't much you can do about your 2010 return after the 31st of December. And what's done is done, with the exception of maybe if one wanted to put money into an IRA. Of course, you'd have to have earned income. To do it, you have until April 15th, 2011 to put it in for 2010.
And that brings up another thing. If you are self-employed, you can open up an SEP, which is a simplified employer plan. I forget.
Employer.
Simplified. I always wanted to call it the self-employment plan, but
that's what I call them.
Yeah. But the literal term is simplified employer plan. And you can put in about a quarter of your earnings.
Yeah.
And it's a great way to save on taxes. Plus, you're investing. You can invest it in whatever you want. And therefore, we hope, grow it. So that's the type of thing a professional can tell you. Because how would I have known? You know
what's nice about that, John? Now, what John's talking about, for those of you that may... might be a small amount of self-employment, might be a large amount, but you can have a self-employed retirement plan once you retire, even though you're retired. And you say, how can you do that? Well, don't argue. They come in different varieties. John mentioned one called a SEP, self-employed plan, and you have to be self-employed to do it, and you can put an awful lot of money into it. Now, if the profit is, let's say, small, under $5,000 or $6,000, an IRA could act to do the same thing. And then they even have jazzier ones. They call them Una K. And I think we all know how the thrift works. If the thrift is sometimes referred to as a 401k plan, although it's not, but it walks and quacks like
right.
one. And I think the listening audience knows that if somebody has not attained the age of 50, they can put in $16,500. If they're 50 or over, they can put in $22,000. Now, if they have one of these Unique plans and they're self-employed, they can put in the first $22,000 of profit. Just goes in, plus 20% of the profit over that. So you can really load up on those things. But as John indicated, you can do this after the end of the year. And with those, if you file an extension to file your tax return in October, you can even put off the funding of it until October 2011 for 2010. Not an IRA, but these plans, John.
SEPs. Mm-hmm. SEPs. That's a good deal.
It's a great deal. And actually, the UNIK you can't set up after the end of the calendar year, but the SEP you can. So in other words, for those of you all listening, if you didn't have one of these, you could still set one up. Not the UNIK. And then the other things to look at as far as doing your 2010 return. Again, there isn't much you can pay other than what we just talked about, but you can certainly dig a little bit deeper. There isn't much you're going to do with state and local income tax. There isn't much you're going to do with real estate taxes. Isn't much you're going to do with interest itemized deductions. Now, charities, on the other hand, the great years of creativity are past us. So now what you give needs to be supportable. If you donate by check, you can reasonably expect to get documentation if you haven't gotten it already soon from now from the recipient organization. And then non-cash. Now, all the IRS says is, listen, don't be hoggish with this. Just give what you figure the market value is. And where people used to get in trouble, they had this vivid imagination that these threadbare clothes or this old clunker was worth a fortune, and they claimed it. And if it was worth that much, I think they would have sold it. So Congress said, fine, just do this. If it's a non-cash item, if the total for the entire year of all the things that you gave away of a non-cash variety is under $500, put down the reasonable market value. If it's over $500, they'd like you to tell them, not in any grand dialogue, but just, you know, I gave this date, I bought it for this, it was worth this, and this is what I'm claiming. Collectively, if it's over $500, that form will tie into what's on your itemized deductions.
And is that in the comments section of your 1040? Where do you put that?
Attach a note? I think it's a form 8363.
Of course it's a form, okay. Yeah, I just donated a car in 2011, so I won't be dealing with it this year. But how it works, and I call two different places, it works the same way, is that they pick up your car right away. That's the nice thing, because I just wanted to get this off my driveway. But eventually they'll auction it off, and they will be presented with a document how much it was auctioned off for. So you have that, presumably, as proof of what it was worth.
And the outfit that you donated the car to coincidentally sends that same thing to the IRS.
I'm not surprised.
Okay, so in the IRS computer, there will be something that John and Beth sold their car for X.
Mm-hmm.
Look for it on their 1040.
Now, or donated it.
And donate it. And then if their tax return is X plus something, then they might get a reminder notice. What else did you give? Now, let's say that the organization does not auction the car. Most, I would say, do, not all. But let's say some people are given cars by a charitable organization so that they can get to work. Or they use the car, or let's say it's a pickup, in the pursuit of the charitable organization's mission. So there is going to be no sale. Now, here is where you do get the proverbial blue book, but be sober with it.
Right. And you can access Blue Book online and get the Blue Book price.
Mm-hmm. And don't do the retail.
You know,
there's three of them. There's wholesale, there's seller, and then there's retail. Probably seller would be the middle ground.
Right. It's very easy to do, to find the right Blue Book value of your car. If that's what you need to do for pricing it to sale, or in this case, assessing the value for the tax deduction.
Yes.
Very easy to do. I think it's probably bluebook.com, but you can Google Blue Book and you'll get right there.
All righty. So that's pretty much things in the rearview mirror, other than what's called miscellaneous deductions. And I have people call up and say, gee, can I deduct TurboTax. And my usual wise guy response to that is, what's TurboTax? And and because I prepare returns for a living. And can you deduct the cost to monitor your investment? Let's say a Kiplinger's personal finance. I'm not saying you should buy any of these, or a money magazine, or if you go to a fee-only financial planner, or you pay somebody to manage them. All this is, quote, deductible in there. What else would be? Professional dues, subscriptions, magazines, journals. Maybe you took a course that wasn't offered at the agency to become better at your job. All these things are kind of like unreimbursed expenses, and they go into an area called miscellaneous. And it's much like medical, though. Medical, you can deduct most medical things that you pay, but only if the sum total exceeds 7.5% of your total income. So most people don't get this.
And most people don't want it because that means they probably have some...
Had an ailment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So who wants that?
Okay. Now, on the miscellaneous, it's the exact same concept, but the number is different and has to exceed 2% of your income. But 2% of your income is going to be a high number relative to what you should be potentially paying for a tax return and or some of these other things. Now, if you're paying somebody to manage your money, that's a different story. That might be more money depending on the amount of money that you have under management. But people get excited about that. But I find this is where people forget things, too. The other stuff is fairly obvious. Interest deductions and charities. And
I'll say a word about TurboTax that you'll appreciate.
Okay.
We used TurboTax while I was self-employed, since I retired. We used to do it manually for years and years.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, we had a system.
Okay.
One read the documents from our file, and one entered the stuff on the form. Then we went to TurboTax. Now, did TurboTax ask me the question, are you self-employed and therefore indicating that I can open an SEP? No. I found that by hiring somebody like Bob. So there you go.
Yeah, TurboTax cues you into some things now more so than they did in the past. But this is going to sound very self-serving. I get calls all year long from clients, not just tax season, but I even urge them to call before the end of the year because after the end of the year, there isn't much you're going to be able to do, as we just mentioned. So having a tax professional take care of your return, you should have access to them certainly during tax season, but the rest of the year, tax law comes out, and they're not the easiest thing to read about in the paper, and you might say, okay, how does this impact me? Or, am I reading this right? And it helps for those, you know, maybe where it's a fairly straightforward return. I don't know that you need to spend the money to have a tax prepare, but to be frank, you ought to have a tax program because everything is so interrelated to X percent of this or Y percent of that, and that's just really hard to do, man.
Yeah, well, our decision a few years ago, we were selling some stock, actually a real estate investment trust. But, yeah, if you're getting into this a year where you're selling stocks and so forth and so on, and coincidentally, or you're self-employed, you might want to, it's probably well worth your while and whatever it costs to have a professional do it.
All righty. Now, let's, looking at it in advance, 2011, what can we do during the year to take advantage of some of these provisions and the change in the law? I guess the major one is for those that are having Social Security withheld from their salary, and some of our audience isn't, but probably most of it is. But whoever you are, if you're not having Social Security withheld, this really has no impact to you. But if you are, this is huge. There's a Social Security tax holiday for 2011 such that 2% of what would otherwise have been withheld from your salary to go to Social Security is not going to be. It's going to be, if you will, returned to you. Not taxed, so it's kind of a tax-free thing. And what are you going to do with it? If you haven't maximized your thrift, boy, what a great way to turn a non-taxable event into a tax-deductible event. Some people would say, no, I just want to spend it. I have no good answer for that.
Well,
other than you
my grandfather said all decisions in life are not financial.
Yeah. And others would say, well, you know, would you advise, let's say they're talking to me, I have credit card debt and I can put money into the TSP. Now, if you have credit card debt and you're paying 12, 14, 16, 18, 20%, I think I'm paying the credit card debt down. Unless maybe I'm in FERS and I haven't met my match max. That'd be the only reason I'd say go to the TSP first if you got real high credit card debt. Use that money to help pay it down. You're not going to make a guaranteed 20% or 18% or 14% anywhere, even in the thrift. I said guaranteed now, but it's guaranteed if you don't pay your credit card, you're going to be paying that in interest.
Right.
So that's nice. It's a year-long deal. It's for 2011. And you know, we'd like to say, gee, it'll be longer, but it can't be longer. So
I had a question the other day about taxes. Guy owes a redeposit, which means he left the government, took a refund. He owes, if he wants to get credit for the service, he owes the money plus accrued interest. And he asked, is the interest deductible?
And the answer is yes, but not like you think it would be. Let's use a number example, just really simple. And you can multiply this by whatever your own example is. Let's say that the redeposit principal is $1,000. Let's just do that. Again, multiply it by whatever yours might be. Yours is the listening group. When that money goes into OPM, there's no tax deduction until the person retires. When that person retires, they've now put $1,000 in plus all the withholding that they've had for retirement, not the thrift, for the retirement portion, coming out of their paycheck each time they get one, and it stops when they retire. When they retire, they'll have that pot of money plus this $1,000 that will become a tax deduction against their annuity benefit. But that's not what John asked. John asked, what about the interest portion? So we've got a redeposit now, and we're going to have interest paid on it. There'll be no current tax deduction when that interest payment is made along with the redeposit. Why? Because it's not home mortgage interest. It's not equity line interest. You could say it's investment interest, but that won't work for a current tax deduction. But when would it be deductible? It would go into that same pot with all the other money, the money that was withheld during the entire career. Now the $1,000 redeposit plus the interest will then be totaled, and it will be divided by the, if you will, the projected life expectancy of the annuity, and then a little bit of that is deducted each year. So, yes, it's deductible, but not all at once.
Yes, and how do you figure out all this out? You don't have to, because on your 1099-R that you get in January, they show you what the your actual annuity payments were and what your taxable portion of your annuity is. So it's real easy. It's all done for you. It wasn't always. Exactly the time I retired was the first year they did it. So I'm not saying.
When did you retire?
I retired in 2002. In January 2003 was the first 1099-R where OPM provided this service before, and it wasn't hard to do. You could figure it out. But I was always concerned that a lot of people just might forget to calculate the taxable portion of their annuities. I bet there were a number of people. I could be wrong. I have no way of checking.
There were. I did a lot of amended returns.
Thank you.
Over my
that
years.
Was my concern.
Yeah, yeah.
But since 2003, OPM does it for you on the 1099-R, which is the retiree's version of a W-2, I guess. And so it's real easy if you're paying attention to such things, or your tax preparer certainly should be paying attention, to put in the right amount of taxable annuity.
And one, just to double check that.
Now, I don't think they did it just for me, but.
No, they didn't do it just for you. They changed. Now, they changed for two reasons. One, what you said, and the other was the exact opposite of what you said. People took liberties with this, and there was no way to police it. So Congress said, here, you're going to do this. Now, this year, 2010, the 1099-R that John mentioned, which is the equivalent of a W-2. You get it at the end of the year because you're retired. You get a W-2 at the end of the year because you're an employee. Now, on a W-2, you have a taxable wage, which is your gross wage minus your thrift. Now, the annuity is your gross annuity is going to be on one box on the left-hand side. Now, it wasn't there last year. It was in the center last year in 2009. In 2010, it's going to be on the left-hand side. There are just two boxes, just like John said. One's going to say gross annuity, X, and taxable annuity, X minus this number that we're talking about. So the number in and of itself doesn't show anywhere. It's in there by osmosis, and if you just subtract the one from the other, you'll know what it is. Now, the total amount that the individual put in is going to be on that form. Now, the total amount that the individual put in, again, is the entire career of withholdings plus any redeposits, military buyback, etc. Left federal service, came back, that money's in there, paid interest on it, that money's in there. But then that gets to another question that sometimes argues with tax and finance. Finance says, yeah, I'm going to get this greater annuity because I'm making the redeposit. Finance says, yeah, but I'm going to get a tax deduction. And then the really financial says, well, what if you don't pay it back? What does it really cost you each month, and how long does it take to recoup that?
Right. And this is, we're talking to not every federal employee or and subsequently retiree. What we're talking about is CSRS-covered employees who took a refund for a period of service that ended prior to March 1st, 1991. And if you choose not to pay it back, and virtually everyone who's made aware of this law chooses not to pay it back, you still get credit for the money, I mean for the service, for both eligibility to retire and in the computation of your annuity. Yes, there's an actuarial reduction to your annuity, but I'll just give you an example. I do emails, and here was one example. Guy said, I'm retiring at, he was in this category, of course, I retire at 60 and I owe $50,000. See, the interest is the killer, so that's why I owe $50,000. And how much would my monthly annuity be reduced? And I said, well, I look on this present value factor table, which we include in our seminar books, by the way. And somebody retiring at age 60 has a present value factor of 198.8, and I divide that into 50K, and it tells me that his annuity would be reduced $250 a month, or about, what is that, $3,000 a year, a little over $3,000 a year. Well, how many years is it going to take up to make $50,000 that he'd hand to OPM, which he's free to do, and eliminate that $250 a month reduction? Over 16 years. To make up the difference. So if you got $50,000, unless you probably should be investing it anyway and probably trying to grow it. So that's just if the $50,000 never grows, it's going to take you over 16 years to make up that money you hand to OPM. So I think, you know, that's why when people are made aware of it, and federal employees are generally pretty smart, when they're made aware of these things, they say, well, heck, I'm not going to pay that back, and that's the right answer.
Very well put. Financial planning focus there, because the $50,000 or the $10,000, whatever the number is, if it was left outside, it would earn something. So it probably pushes that example out a little
further,
bit.
Further, it pushes the recoupment period even further out than 16 years. If you put that money in and earn 7%, if my memory serves, it would take you 32 years. And 7%, you know, if you have a mix of stocks and bonds over time, is not an unrealistic expectation. It's a reasonably conservative estimate. So, yeah, it doesn't pay to pay it back in that situation. Now, again, this is only for those set of people. Now, the period for which you took a refund, and we're still talking SIRS, and I'll get to FERS right after this, but the period ended March 1st, 1991 or later, then you still get credit for the service for eligibility, but if you don't pay the redeposit, you don't get credit for the computation. Then the answer reverses itself. Even if you owe this large amount of money, if you can come up with it, it probably is cost-effective to pay it, because if you do the math, by you know, not paying it versus paying it, you know, subtracting those years from the annuity computation, it doesn't take you that many years in retirement to make that up in higher annuity. Even if you owe large amounts, of course, some people can't come up with the large amounts, but if you can or borrow it, it might be a good idea to look at paying that back. Now, for the first people, it's much simpler. If you owe a refund, and since 2009, October, you are now allowed to pay that money back, redeposit the money with interest. But that's the only way you get credit for it. So again, I say it's cost effective. Anytime you're not getting credit for service in the computation of your annuity, but you could by paying money into the fund, and that includes the military deposit, it's generally cost effective to try and get that money paid back. And you don't, if you're still employed, you don't have to pay that back in one fell swoop. In fact, you can set up a schedule for yourself. Doesn't have to be a regular monthly payment. It just whenever you have money to start paying, you know, pay it back, you can pay it back periodically, you know, if you don't have a big pot of money lying
around.
Well
put. And as John indicated, he hit the bullseye. Economics should always come before tax. In other words, people say, well, look at my tax deductions. Yeah, look what you had to do to get them. There are very rare exceptions to that comment, but unfortunately people get very swayed about how much they can deduct. Now, following your question, there was an email. We got some best of emails this week. An individual wrote in, I'm planning to retire at age 62. I was born February 19th, 1961. And she entered the government in September 2001. Well, I mean, I'd like the idea that they were planning well in advance, but it's hard to say the best date to retire many years from now. Who knows?
Well, it is. However, I Googled, I forget the terminology, I could find it again, but I Googled the I typed in the appropriate words to bring up a chart of when the last day of the pay period, the last pay year date ended. This coming year, it's December 31st. But starting the following year, it jumps up to almost mid-January. So, but it prints out in your screen several years in the future. So you can, if you wish, start planning. But you really don't need to. I mean, if you're not going to retire till 2016 or whatever, you know, you can kind of wait till a year before when things are a little clearer as to what the last day of the last pay period in the year are.
But I thought the question was good. You're right, John. But I thought the question was good, but more an indirect answer to the question. And on the best date to retire, like John says, you could figure it out. But the better question is when can I afford to retire? And the TSP website's really got some nifty tools on it. It's www.tsp.gov. And then it has something called planning tools. And it gives you an idea how much you need to save to fund the lifestyle to which you want to remain accustomed. And this will take into consideration inflation rates, tax rates, and the like. And this person's clearly FERS, and we see a major shift in the classes that we address that now maybe one out of fours is CSRS and the other one are FERS when 8 years ago it was the exact opposite. So we're going to have more FERS people, and they need to pay closer attention to this.
Yes, the TSP calculator is an invaluable, indispensable tool in your retirement planning because for no other reason your TSP account can be, for some people, even higher than 50% of their total income. And if you don't use the calculator, how much are you going to know? How can you plan for retirement? You can't.
No, I'm a bean counter and I use calculators.
Yeah. And it can do a lot of functions. That being one is how much money will I need in retirement? But it can also show you you know, if I keep contributing X amount each pay period for this many years and I take the one, how much will I have when I retire or when I want to take the money out if after retirement? And it will tell you. And then it can convert it into monthly payments and tell you how long equal monthly payments would last. It can calculate if you use purchase an annuity with your account, it'll calculate how much your annuity monthly annuity payments would be. So if you don't use the calculator, how are you ever going to know any of this stuff? The answer is you're not.
Alrighty, then I got another one this week. It was actually a letter from a guy who retired earlier than anticipated and covered under FERS, and the years in service were not great. So the FERS annuity together with Social Security, or in this case a supplement because they retired early, the person's living in a one-room rent a room and is behind in their taxes. That's what I'm getting at, the taxes. And so, you know, what do I do? And, you know, I have to eat. And there are a couple years where the IRS has got liens and the like. And it's sad. And I don't usually say, oh, you know, just run up your IRS debt and you can get out of it, which is very hard to do. But in some cases, they will grant what they call an offer in compromise. That's actually what it's called. And it's filling out a lot of forms, not hard forms. They just want to know, what do you own? What are you getting in? And the IRS doesn't want to be your bank. So if you have the ability to borrow money to pay the prior debt, they're not going to forgive the tax. And I'm not remotely suggesting that they would forgive all the taxes, but they might say, listen, if you can put together a certain percent of what you owe based on what you say here, then we will take the lesser amount. But from here on, you have to keep your nose clean as far as paying taxes. So we discussed this offer and compromise. It's not an easy thing to do. I'll be very frank. Years ago, I used to do it for people. I wouldn't do it for people that were just trying to scam the system, but I did it for people that were down on their luck. But there was a perception built up that all they had to do is go to somebody that does this, and they automatically are going to get a 75% reduction. And then I found that the perception gap with these people, you could not change it. And if I didn't get a huge discount, then what's wrong with me? So I just decided, well, I go through all that, I just won't do it anymore. And it's tougher to get than it once was. Anyway, just a side comment. So that was the best of, kind of in a planning sense, and the best of to provide somebody some relief that maybe had fallen on bad times. Now, we're running a little close to the deadline, not exactly, but the long-term care folks are back in focus. What do you know about that?
Well, we just got word from OPM that they're going to have a long-term care open season for the federal plan, and it's going to start April 4th, and it's going to run through June 24th of this year. And what does the open season get you? Now, you can sign up for the federal plan anytime you want, but you got to fill out the long questionnaire, which consists of 40 questions. The open season, you only have to answer 7, and if you want to do your spouse, get her, him or her, I should say, in a long-term care insurance, 9 questions. So it's, you know, a nice almost 3-month opportunity, if you don't have long-term care insurance, to start looking at long-term care insurance. And if you decide on the federal plan, it's going to be a lot easier to get in one. If you've been turned down before by the federal plan, you might also want to use this open season, if you're an employee, to do the 7 questions as opposed to the usual 40. Now, retirees, there's no open season for retirees. So if you're retired, and you may still get long-term care insurance as a retiree, always could, you're just going to have to fill out the 40 questionnaire. Now, I've encountered in seminars people who have filled out the long form and said it's not really a difficult thing to do, but obviously if you're like me, you hate filling out forms and you always end up making a mistake and getting frustrated. So 7 questions is a lot easier to deal with than 40. We can all agree on that. So that's what's coming up starting April 4th. Your agency should be getting out an announcement about that, but if you're listening, you've heard it first. maybe Mike Causey's column. Oh, I'm sure Mike Causey's column at some point before the open season will put in an announcement. So, but what I would say to people who don't have long-term care, and most don't, you should take a look at it. At least price it out. Now, how do you know how much it costs? Well, there's a great website, LTCFeds.com.
I guess LTC stands for long-term care.
Right, and Feds stands for feds.
Okay, thank you.
Federal employees, I guess. Anyway, Feds, LTCFeds.com. And in addition to explaining how it works and so forth, they have a calculator. And you have several options you can choose from. I won't go into them now, but you can read about the options and what they mean at the website. And then when you decide, oh, I think I'll get this plan and this daily amount, and you know, I'll get inflation protection, you plug that in, and ba-boom, they spit out, here's the monthly premium. And, of course, your age at which you purchase it, because the younger you are, the less it is. So, you know, then you can say, hey, this isn't too bad, or this is too bad, and I can't afford this. But if you purchase long-term care insurance from the federal plan or a private sector plan, and you're in your 50s, it tends not to be that expensive. And of course, what's expensive to some is not expensive to others, and vice versa, of course. But you at least will see if you want to purchase this.
Right. And we probably will have the long-term care folks themselves on for a show or two. And they don't sell the product. They just talk about how it works and answer questions.
They're not on commission or anything.
They're not here to sell anything.
No.
And generally, it's a very good show and a refreshing show. And interestingly enough, we have Art Stein on next week on this show. And Art Stein is a financial planner first and happens to know a lot about long-term care second. He's on the show more for the financial planning than the long-term care, but I know that will come up, and he remembers on the other side, not that he doesn't like the federal plan, but he'll talk about, well, you know, the private sector.
Yeah, and here's what I recommend to people. Go to the federal's website, use the calculator. It'll spit out the numbers. I said design a plan that would meet your needs. And then I recommend take that and shop around. You know, take it to an insurance company. I mean, John Hancock currently has a contract for underwriting the federal plan, but you can also buy a private plan through John Hancock. Maybe you can get it cheaper privately, but you don't know that until you first start out with a federal calculator, take it to the agent and say, what can you do for me? The same type of plan, what's it going to cost? Maybe you can get it cheaper. It probably won't be a huge difference, or maybe you can't. You know, but then you know. Then you say, aha, well, I'll go with the federal plan then.
Very good. John, while you were talking, I thought of something. At the top of the show, we talked about the 1099-R with regards to a federal retiree, and now they make the taxable calculation automatically for the federal, but they don't for the state. So here's another potential gap somebody could fall into, that if they looked at the 1099-R and they're retired, and said, oh, that's the taxable amount. For the federal, that must be the same for the state if you live in a state that uses the federal numbers. Well, not necessarily. So there are a significant number of states in the country that has an additional tax benefit for living in there. And some states, actually, you don't pay tax on your annuity. Pennsylvania would be one. New York, Massachusetts comes to mind. North Carolina, you have to meet a test. And then there are states that don't even have a state income tax. And NARF puts out a very good summary of all the states in the country that have these different attributes. And usually it's in their March, sometimes their April publication.
Our NARF is the National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees, or words to that effect.
Yeah.
And it's like AARP, but specifically designed for federal employees and retirees. It's a great organization.
And that monthly publication,
it's chock full. Oh, yeah. The Q&As alone, you'll learn something. But yeah, there are articles that can be very valuable to you. Maybe not every month, but certainly on a frequent basis. But the Q&As alone, which are feature of the monthly magazine where readers write in, and then, of course, they get an answer, are really educational.
Yeah, and there's always one column in there, a financial planner locally writes it, but it's for the whole country.
Yeah, and
I like that.
And they deal with all sorts of issues, not just the financial issues. Best places to retire, they did an issue. They have in the monthly, they have a doctor. She actually looks like my doctor. When I looked at her picture, I thought, that's my doctor, but she isn't. But anyway, she writes a health column each month. So there's a lot of good stuff, and you can get in it. The membership is almost free. It's about $3 or $4 a month.
Well worth it.
Yeah, well worth it. Yeah.
And of course, the best thing to do is come to one of our retirement seminars or mid-career seminars or beginning career seminars or mini seminars.
I know this sounds self-serving, but I think it's true nonetheless that I wouldn't retire without taking a seminar. I mean, even my wife took a seminar, even though she's married to somebody who does these seminars. And I encouraged her to do so, you know. You'll always learn something. And if you learn one thing, and usually your agency's paying for it, so it's not costing you any money, that might make all the difference. Some people find out that they can retire sooner than they thought.
Yeah. And we generally spend the first day, if it's a 2 or 3 day seminar, just on benefits. And because the federal retirement system, I won't say is so complex, it has so many opportunities that one wants to make sure that they avail themselves because it has to last them for the rest of their life.
Right.
All righty, final comments. We're coming down to the end of the show.
Well, best date to retire this coming year, so-called best date, is going to be, again, December 31st. That's the last day of the final pay period this year. And one question I get frequently is, well, will I get paid for all of my annual leave? And as long as you retire no later than December 31st, if you have annual leave over 240, let's say you have 400 hours or 300 hours, you get paid for the whole thing, and it'll be paid in tax year 2012, which is also a good thing, rather than 2011.
That's right.
And that's another frequent question.
And it used to get a kick up in cola, but not next year. Anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks, John. Do your tax return. Any questions, you can email us at foryourbenefit@nitpinc.com. Or give us a call next week, and I'll give you the number when we're on air with Art Stein. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
Plan now to attend the Federal Senior Management Conference, the preeminent conference for federal senior managers, on April 10th through the 13th in beautiful Cambridge.